Okay, yeah. So, Hannah, we've been hearing for months about the need for a regional approach to the homeless crisis. Now, King County and Seattle have laid out the rough draft of a plan to do just that. Is that right? Tell us all about it.
So there's been so much criticism about the city and the county's fragmented system of addressing the homeless crisis. In Seattle, a half dozen different departments address different parts of the homeless response, and the county has its own system, as do other cities in the county. There are also separate philanthropic and business community efforts. Now, following the recommendations in a recent report commissioned by Seattle and King County, local leaders say it's time to combine all of those efforts and tackle homelessness as a region.
Mayor Durkin and I will work with our respective councils to produce formalized agreements between our two governments. But let's be clear, we will stand up, we will staff, and we will fund a new entity, combining the homelessness work of King County, of Seattle, of All Home, and of our partners.
County Executive Dale Constantine says that new entity, which at this point doesn't have a name, will be led by a small board that will have a director.
There are many hurdles to pass. There are many questions to answer. But we are committed to this course because the challenge we face demands a response that is greater than what we can accomplish acting separately. These reforms will not by themselves solve homelessness. But we must have a foundation that is data-driven, that is transparent, that is customer-focused, and we must have a single point of accountability.
So the plan would see the county and Seattle follow recommendations to merge their spending and operations, with the new agency having the policymaking authority. That agency would also work with philanthropic efforts, business community efforts, and hopefully other cities in the county.
I'm very encouraged by working and talking to the other mayors around this region who also want to be part of this regional governance and response. They need to go back to their membership, and we're very cognizant that we have 39 cities in King County, and that each city has its own unique challenges and response, but we need to make sure that everybody can be at the table.
As for what to expect as far as results, Mayor Jenny Durkin echoing Constantine's sentiments that this would not be a single fix.
We know that this mechanism won't solve homelessness, but we also know we cannot make the advances we need to make without this, and we're laying the foundation for a new era and a new approach to homelessness.
And while they said this new agency would be funded, it is not clear how, and asked whether taxpayers would be asked to foot the bill for this.
Ultimately, the question of whether more resources are required or what part of this spectrum they're required in will need to be answered. And I think that our goal should be to get to the point where we're not having to invest so much in emergency response, and that can be shifted to the things that get to the root causes and get people back on track, rather than simply assuming we have to add money to all phases of this.
Neither Constantine or Durkin ruling it out.
I think it is premature to say, do we need more resources? We got to get a lot smarter about the resources upstream and those approaches and the upstream causes. And once we get this right, the goal is to have the smallest emergency response you have, because you've diverted people away from the system.
I also asked, you know, there's been a lot of criticism every time they roll out a plan, one table, some other new way to address the homeless crisis. There are criticisms that it's just a new plan or a new committee or a new panel of some sort. I asked how this is different.
That is the inevitable criticism whenever you try to do something new. I mean, the thing we have now is doing a lot of good work, but it's not getting us over that hill and getting us to the solutions we want. The criticism is around whether we're just rearranging the deck chairs. We're not. We're rebuilding the ship. We're creating a vessel that can better accomplish what we want to do collectively.
So in the months ahead, they'll try to do what they need to do in the county and city level to merge their operations, their funding, try to get all of the other cities in the county on board and do that as well. Come and team up with the the Gates Foundation. Yeah. Vulcan was there yesterday, and this is really modeled off of some successful programs that other regional authorities that other cities across the country have done. Ohio was mentioned. I believe Cleveland has been very successful. Minnesota has some very successful programs where they have a regional authority. So in the end, in the months ahead, in the years ahead, I think that this could be very promising. It remains to be seen how it all plays
out. It is puzzling, though, isn't it, to those of us who live here, that more and more money keeps being put toward this problem. People have the best of intentions, and yet the homelessness population rises year after year after year. We're actually third place in the country right now, I believe, right? So,
and there's a reason for that. So this is something that was explained to me yesterday, right? You always see the tents all along the sidewalks,
right? That's
and
what
it doesn't
people
seem like
see.
It gets any better. And it's not that they have made big strides in getting more people off the street. The problem is, as they explained, that getting to the root causes, keeping people from becoming homeless in the first place is their main focus, because that rate of people becoming homeless because of the housing crisis and the expensiveness of housing
right now
is outpacing that of them getting people off the streets who are already homeless.
Yeah, so I wonder if that's just something that happens with a boom town, is that you have the high income earners plunking down a lot of money every month for rent, and then people who are on the borderline in terms of income just can't find housing at all.
Yeah, and it's certainly a big issue in our city, but it's also an issue across the country in many places right now. So we'll see how it plays out.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
The clock is still ticking toward a partial government shutdown, but the Senate did take a step forward last night. We called up CBS's Stephen Portnoy at the White House for details.
It's always so interesting to see how we have high drama in Washington. Both sides seemingly have intractable positions, and yet this is an old cliche, but there's nothing more powerful in Washington, D.C. than the jet fumes that emanate from aircraft that will take members of the House and Senate back home in time for Christmas. So last night, overwhelmingly, the Senate approved this short-term stopgap 7-week continuing resolution, or CR as it's called, that would fund the key agencies whose funding expires tomorrow night. It would take it through February 8th, which allows both sides the time to sort of retrench, regroup, recharge their batteries, because neither side was spoiling for a fight right now.
Right. Nobody wants that around the holidays.
And the fact is that a number of Republicans who are either losing their seats because they lost re-election or they are retiring at the end of this Congress really have no impetus or incentive to stay in Washington for votes. Right. Several dozen have already stopped showing up. Last night, there weren't even 400 members of the House who showed up for a test vote, almost a parliamentary procedural vote. And that indicates that a number of these Republicans particularly have just completely cashed out. And without them, the president doesn't have the ability in the House his party still controls to get what he wants done.
Well, that's what confused me. I heard that without some Democratic votes that this would not pass, and then I thought, well, why do they need the Democrats? Don't the Republicans control both
houses? Well, it's twofold. It's the fact that the a number of Republicans who are not returning have, as I mentioned, checked out and have senioritis. And the other point is that a number of Republicans who are members of the Freedom Caucus, who are really truly loyal to the president, would not support a bill that doesn't have exactly what the president wants, which is this extra $5 billion for the border wall. And without that, they're not going to vote for it. Without the moderate Republicans who aren't coming back, there aren't enough Republicans to pass it by their majority basis alone. So that's why you're going to read and hear that Democrats are sort of in the driver's seat on this. And come January 3rd, 2 weeks from today, they will constitute the House majority, which means it'll be much more difficult for the president to get what he wants, which is why you're hearing a number of key conservatives in the media ecosphere say that the president is caving on this and will never get what he wants.
Okay, yeah, that was my next question. Does this mean this is the end of the road for the president's dream for the wall?
Well, the president still has two things. He's got the veto pen, and the ability to not sign whatever Congress sends him, which could lead to a shutdown. The other aspect is the fact that his party still controls the Senate. And that means, in fact, his margin in the Senate is expanded by two seats, which means that he has a tremendous amount of leverage in these negotiations. But the fact that the Democrats now control the House, and for the first time in 8 years, means that they're ready to assert themselves and their priorities. It seems to me the last time we had this kind of dynamic in Washington was nearly 25 years ago, when Republicans took over control of the House when Bill Clinton was president. It resulted in a couple of shutdowns.
Well, moving on over to Moscow, Vladimir Putin said this morning that he's very happy with the president's plan to pull out of Syria. That sentiment is not shared by many lawmakers in D.C., and also apparently not shared by some of the members of the president's own administration. Is that right?
Yeah. One administration official told CBS News yesterday it was catastrophic for the president to make this announcement so swiftly. A number of people at the Pentagon and in the State Department and across the national security apparatus of the federal government did not see this coming. The president tweets this morning, it shouldn't be a surprise to anybody that he's making this move. You know, he flirted with it earlier this year, and he campaigned on it in 2016. He said before the U.S. intervened in Syria in 2013 that it would be a bad idea. And so he says he's just following through on what he's always wanted to do in this regard, and that is bring American troops home and not have to get involved in this problem, because he says, in his words, quote, we won in the fight against ISIS.
Okay, CBS White House correspondent Stephen Portnoy. Okay, time for Choke Points, brought to you by Online Trading Academy. This is Chris's last Choke Point of 2018. I'm almost sad to see the year go, but I'm sure we'll find other traffic woes to talk about in the new year.
Yeah, definitely.
And so you're wrapping up some stories from earlier this year and starting your Highway 99 closure clock as well.
Yeah, 22 days out. And I know the last thing that you'll want to be thinking about over Christmas and New Year's is your plan for the upcoming Alaskan Way Viaduct closure. But I cannot stress enough how much of an impact this is actually going to have on all of us. Even if you don't use the 99 corridor, 90,000 vehicles a day use Highway 99.
Wow.
And it's going to be shut down for 3 weeks. Those cars have got to go somewhere. Heather Marks is director of mobility for the city of Seattle.
There's no doubt about it. It is going to be tough. There is no, don't be confused about that at all.
You should plan on all north-south streets between South Lake Union and downtown Seattle to take diversion from southbound 99 users. All north-south streets from Burien into downtown will take the northbound of your diversion. And I-5 is also going to handle a lot of the load.
There really are very few routes north and south. You know, pick an avenue. You know, there aren't very many of them. And so, and then I-5, it's, the choices are not many.
So talk to your boss. See if you can work from home or off shift during a couple of days during that 3 week closure. Maybe a week. I don't know. Take the bus. Find a carpool buddy. We all need to pitch in to make this bearable, because if nobody does anything different, what we've seen as our worst travel days is going to be pale in comparison to what we are anticipating. And I know that sounds like the sky's falling. We do this every time we have these major closures, but I mean, this is the real deal.
Right.
In my estimation. And, you know, this is going to be have an impact. And don't fall into the old trap that we normally do on these, which is the first 2 or 3 days or the first 1 or 2 days. We're like,
right,
okay, we do our thing. And then we go, oh, my gosh, look how great it is. There's no traffic. And then on day 3 or 4, we all go back to our routine.
It's a disaster.
And then it's just gone. Then nobody, don't fall into that trap. So, you know, this is something we got to take seriously. We're going to be pumping this up over the next couple of weeks, reports on this all the time. So, yeah, we're going to be keeping you abreast of what's happening and what you should be doing moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't hype. This is just plain math. We have a certain number of people who have to get a certain number of places, and it's going to have to happen one way or another.
Yeah.
Well, Chris, what is your prediction for what do you think is going to happen?
Well, I expect that I-5 is going to take a lot of the diversion, and the surface streets through downtown, the north-souths, you know, are just going to get hammered. People in West Seattle, I really feel for them, because they really have no options to get. It's hard enough getting out of there as well, but getting across the West Seattle Bridge to I-5 with 99 being closed, that's just going to be a disaster. But enough about the impending doom. We've got plenty, 22 days left to talk about. I want to end the year on a positive note. And I've got some really good news for those of you in the Puyallup area. I highlighted this in an earlier choke point this year. Shaw Road in Puyallup is going to be reopening tomorrow. It's going to be great news for commuters. This is a popular shortcut for locals who try to bypass South Meridian, Highway 512 to 167 into Sumner. A lot of the cars have been using detours since April, when a widening project of Shaw Road started. I highlighted it earlier this year, as I said, in a choke point. And plenty of Puyallup commuters have told me that their commutes have doubled. And I've seen the congestion on eastbound 512. That's one of the reasons why it's backed up again today. It's diversion from this locals kind of cut through. So that should go away with tomorrow's reopening of Shaw Road. So, all right, that's good. That's a present for you all. And then to my favorite story of the year from Choke Points, kind of self-serving, patting myself on the back, is
go ahead.
How I was able to help a listener get together with the city of Everett to help address speeding in his neighborhood. You may not, Jim, you may not have heard this story, but I've done a bunch of stories on this since August.
I never miss any of your stories,
yeah,
Chris.
That is true. Or if you do, you listen to or read them on mynorthwest.com. Mm-hmm. Steve Schneider contacted me in August, and he was trying to get through the cut through speeding through his neighborhood, which is east of I-5 in the lower neighborhood there in Everett. So the city gave him a radar gun to track the speeding. Then they put some monitoring strips out there. And then eventually they were decided to put a new Your Speed Is sign in there. That sign just got installed. Went up to the neighborhood this week, took a picture with Steve and the sign. It's up at mynorthwest.com. So I love it
That's
when
great.
I can help our listeners meet with the people that they need to meet with and get to the people that can make the decisions. And anything to make our streets safer, I'm happy about that. So good on Steve for, as he said it, you can either keep complaining or you can do something about it. And he got something done. So good on him.
Did you help Steve get the radar gun?
No, that was part of the thing. When we started talking back and forth through the city, that was one of the things they offered him to say, hey, if you think it's an issue, get us some data. And his data came back with enough stuff. And they're happy to do that to anybody. From what I've heard from Steve, there are other people out there now in the city of Everett who are asking for radar guns to see
if they
have started a little grassroots.
Oh, citizen data collectors.
So I'm responsible for slowing everybody down through neighborhoods.
Okay.
So anyway.
So the people who want to drive fast, they can send the angry emails to you.
To me. Or the Online Trading Academy text line 98973.
That's great. And keeping people safe in that neighborhood, too. That's awesome. Have you ever had one of those days when you have just had it with traffic or politics or pressure because of the holidays? Does it make you wish you could just, I don't know, smash something? Cairo Radio's Heather Bosch found a place where you can.
It's anger, frustration, tension, exhilaration, and the sound of restraint. Just being let go.
It was fun to have permission to break things. My whole life I was trying not to break things. You know?
Sherry is a customer at Seattle's Rage Industry, where manager Brian Opp says you can put on some protective gear.
We have coveralls to put on for you, and then we also have some masks and gloves for you to wear.
Go into a garage-sized concrete room lined with brick and pay to smash stuff up with tools.
There's golf clubs, sledgehammers, bats, a frying pan, and a crowbar.
The classic frying pan.
Yes. We've gone through a lot of frying pans. They're easily breakable.
Opp says his company's owner got the idea after watching a scene from the movie Zombieland.
Come on, break another one.
When survivors of the zombie apocalypse blew off steam by bashing up an antique store.
Doesn't that feel good?
Targets here include a variety of thrift shop glass and dishware, figurines, and office supplies.
Like the computer monitors and printers, you know, they use those type of things, so they enjoy breaking those.
For those customers who want to vent about work. Actually, Opp says Rage Industry is a popular spot for office parties, bachelorette bonding, unique dates, and for those like Sherry who are surviving their own monsters.
I lost one of my daughters almost 5 years ago to cancer, and I have a lot of anger and frustration. And then I found out about this place, and I was really excited that I get permission to break things in a safe place, in a safe way.
And after several minutes of unbridled smashing,
I like throwing the plates against the brick wall. And I was never a sports person, but I actually enjoyed the bat, which surprised me because I didn't even know if I could hit it. I thought I might miss.
You sound a little relieved.
I do. I feel relieved. I really do. I feel better.
Oh, my gosh. That sounds like so much fun. I would love to get in there and just smash everything I can get my hands on. I think it says something about my personality, maybe.
Have you ever actually done it before, like smash stuff in a remodel? It is cathartic.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And in that situation where you get to take out a wall or something.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Daily Dose of Kindness brought to you by Spring Free Trampolines.
The saying, you never know what someone has been through until you've walked in their shoes, is very important for this story. Because when it comes to kindness, we can all be stewards if we pay attention to those little moments that pull at our hearts when we think we see someone who might need a little help and then we act. Karen Minahan knows this all too well as a survivor of a horrible DUI crash where she lost her leg.
21 years ago, I was hit by an impaired driver. I lost a limb, was in the hospital for quite a while, had a number of surgeries, was not expected to survive, sat in a wheelchair for about 10 years, got involved with MAD and with the DUI victim impact panels so that I could give back to my community, because I actually did die a couple of times while I was in the hospital and was very thankful.
Karen glosses over the pain she endured, and doctors said she would never walk again.
I had 28 surgeries. At one point, I didn't even think that I would ever get a limb to fit me. And then I started volunteering in the School of Medicine at the U of Dub, which I've been doing for 16 years. And that's kind of where everything started to turn around in my life. Because of technology and the new kinds of legs that are out there now, I was up walking after I got a beautiful computer leg, and I was up walking within a year. My life just did a 360.
Karen doesn't let her disability stop her, except for maybe on a windy day at the grand opening at the Dick's restaurant in Kent.
I went to Dick's. The wind was just howling that night, and I can pretty much handle just about anything, but I do have my limitations. So I was standing in line. There had to have been at least 150 people waiting in different lines. And so I braced myself because the wind was blowing, and I thought I was going to fall over. So I stood there for about 10 minutes thinking, maybe this isn't what I should be doing tonight, because other entities have said that's happened to them too. So I walked back to my car.
And that's when something really special happened. A man had been watching Karen bracing herself in the wind and saw her prosthetic leg.
He said, I was watching you trying to maintain your balance. That's when he said, we're just about ready to order. He said, you give me your order, you get in the car and stay warm. He said, I'll bring your food out to you. My heart just swelled, and I thought, this guy is wonderful.
Karen says the gesture was simple and yet profound.
Thought to myself, you know, we really do have a lot of wonderful people out in our world. It warmed my heart. I do get a lot of that. I think it's because you have to project a gratitude attitude and how you talk to people, the tone of voice. And I do get a lot of people who are just so kind and so wonderful.
And that's Karen.
That's great. All right, now it's time for our Sports Insider from 710 ESPN Seattle, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Danny O'Neill, thanks for being in here and helping me. I still have the training wheels on every time I
step in.
You know, it's
no, you
it's
don't
difficult.
Need to qualify. Let's go.
Which button do I push? Am I talking at the right time?
Here's the thing, Jim. You control your own destiny. Just remember that.
Really?
You control, like the Seahawks, you control your own destiny.
Do they, though?
Yes, absolutely they do. They win two games and they're in. No ifs, ands, or buts. As the number five seed, probably going to Dallas.
I thought they were controlling their destiny last weekend, though, when they had it easy.
Well, they still got control of it.
I know.
It's just the grip's not quite as tight.
A little tougher. You know, I think we'll talk more about the Seahawks tomorrow, because we'll be a little closer to the game, and I'll be feeling more nervous. I'm going to need you to talk me through that. But today, I would like to ask you about the new-look Mariners and their new-look stadium.
Well, we'll see how the new look is. I guess the lights were up last night, right? It was magenta or pink.
Yes, so.
Well, T-Mobile is the presenting sponsor of the stadium.
Is it magenta or is it pink, the T-Mobile? T-Mobile will tell you it's magenta, and they'll even say more specifically, it's T-Mobile magenta.
I
look and I see pink. I'm sorry.
I was criticized and roundly mocked on our show yesterday afternoon for trying to parse the difference between magenta and pink. So I'm going to stop trying.
It's
whatever.
Like, it's kind of like all the different colors of purple.
Yeah.
Magenta, I guess, falls into that category too, right? Isn't that supposed to be sort of an outcropping of a purple?
Yeah.
In some way?
Yeah. And it matches the Huskies. The Huskies are purple, so I'm okay with that. It's a type of purple.
At least it's not periwinkle or lavender.
Yeah. Is periwinkle blue?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I think it's some sort of a purple blue.
I can't remember. I do know it was in the 64 crayon box. Here's the problem. So Safeco Field, which is what it was known from its inception,
right.
2000, we've never known it as anything else. When you have a corporate sponsor that's hung on something,
yeah.
and it used to have a different name, it becomes easy. You can just disregard it. But with this, what do we call it? T-Mobile Field? That seems weird.
Yeah.
Do you want to call it T-Mobile?
It does. And it's like renaming a monument.
You want to meet at T-Mobile? And the thing about Safeco is Safeco sounded like a stadium name.
Hey, right.
It's just Safeco, and then it's the safe. There's all this. You can't abbreviate T-Mobile. You want to go down to T-Mo? No, that's not going to work. Mm. Let's go get a couple pints at Timo. No. Timo sounds like somewhere you're going for a hair treatment.
I think, you know, part of the problem is that part of the name is already abbreviated. What's the T stand for? I mean, it's just T.
Yeah,
right?
I have no idea.
So T-Mobile, it's already abbreviated.
The T doesn't have to stand for anything. Like Mr. T, that didn't stand for anything, did it?
Well, it stood for righteousness and justice.
No, it didn't. Clubber Lang in Rocky III was the bad guy, Jim.
Oh, I don't remember.
He was a cocky guy who had to get his
comeuppance. I was going back to the A-Team.
Oh, okay.
Okay, Danny, I'm talking A-Team when I think about that. Speaking of A-Team, are we going to have a team?
Yeah, there'll be
when
a
the Mariners
team out
play
there.
Again.
It'll be a team. It'll be lowercase a
yeah.
instead of the uppercase a team.
It'll be a team. It'll be a team of sorts.
If you find 25 players who are capable of playing a little bit of baseball and you can find them, maybe then you can call the Mariners team.
Why do they keep selling
wow,
off
that
our
was
most...
A- Was that was an A-Team reference?
Yeah, it
right
was
there.
From the theme song.
Okay, yeah. You could find. Yeah,
totally
well
over
done.
My head.
Yeah, now they become soldiers of fortune.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh,
had to go underground.
Here's the thing: the L.A. underground is where they escaped to.
Why do we keep selling off our exciting players?
Now the reason is because they were high centered in the middle. Mm-hmm. Their record over the past 5 years is fifth or sixth best in the American League.
Mm-hmm.
Yet they've not made the playoffs in that time. They're stuck in the worst spot.
I see.
Which is, they're good enough to convince yourself and talk yourself into the idea. We add a little bit, we get a little lucky, we'll be in the playoffs this year, but they're not really good enough to contend. And they decided that we're going to get off the hump. We're going to take a step back, which is a risk.
Yeah.
Because when you dip down, there's no guarantee you're going to bob back up. But we're going to take a step back in the short term with the idea that 2 or 3 years from now, we'll be really good. So we're going to take the players we have that have some value right now, Edwin Diaz, James Paxton, and we're going to get guys that we project not only will still be good 3 years from now, 4 years from now, but will be coming into their prime and will be cost controlled. It's a very sound formula. And along with that, trading Robinson Cano, they were able to get out from under a lot of the money they owe him. Not all of it. They're still paying a decent chunk of his salary, and they took back a couple players who, quite frankly, they wouldn't be interested in if they had not been able to part with Robinson. They're taking on the contract of Jay Bruce because the Mets are taking Robinson Cano's contract on. So it's a little bit of shuttling of overpaid parts. But that's okay with the idea. I'm all on board with this.
It's great that we've got this rebuilding season or two, but fans are saying, wait, we've had a rebuilding decade here.
That's not true. And I know why fans say that is because they're frustrated and because they haven't won. The Mariners have never said, we are going to consciously decide to not maximize our wins this next season with the idea of being better 2 to 3 years from now. They've constantly, in my mind, tried to been over eager in adding parts. Eric Bedard, Adrian Beltre, Richie Sexton. All those were moves with the design of, hey, this guy's going to put us over the top and get us into the playoffs next year.
I see.
This is something different. They have never done this before.
So maybe they're thinking long term for the first time.
They've been bad before. They've just never been bad by design. So if they're conscious that they might be bad, that makes it less troublesome that they're bad. That's what I'm trying to tell myself.
That's what I tell myself about myself.
Yeah.
I am bad by design.
Jim, we need to work on your self-talk, man.
It creates...
No, you started out with wondering if you were competent.
Right
now
buttons.
You're doing this. Like, come on. The stories we tell ourselves are really important, Jim.
Oh, this is great.
Yeah.
How much do I owe you for this session?
Well, you just need to grab control of your own destiny, seize control of the reins, and take this show by the horns.
All right. That was our sports insider.
And motivational speaker.
After 2 months of heart-wrenching testimony, lawyers for the victims and loved ones of those killed in the 2015 Ride the Ducks crash have rested their case. Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott gets us up to date on the civil trial. Hey, Hannah.
Hey, so there are more than 40 plaintiffs in this case and nearly a half dozen defendants. That includes Ride the Ducks Seattle, the duck boat manufacturer Ride the Ducks International, as well as the city of Seattle and the state. 5 people were killed in this horrific crash and more than 60 injured when the axle on the duck boat broke, causing the driver to veer into oncoming traffic on the Aurora Bridge, smashing into a charter bus packed with mostly international students from North Seattle College. Now, over the past several weeks, many of those injured on the duck boat and the bus have taken the stand describing the horrific experience.
There was like a crack sound, which I thought he had hit the bridge, which then kind of jarred me a little bit. And then for me, everything just went into slow motion.
This woman was on the duck boat with her husband when it slammed into the bus.
I was just grateful that he was alive and that I was alive because I knew it was bad. I could hear all the noise.
And this woman was sitting right behind the bus driver when it hit the duck boat.
I was had a really hard time breathing, and all the debris and glasses shattered all over my face.
She was among the youngest victims, just 18 at the time of that crash. And while she's healed from her physical injuries, she told the jury she still struggles emotionally.
It's just sad because I feel like I really want to go back to that time where I was that happy.
We also heard some emotional testimony from family members of five people killed in the crash, including the son of an Austrian woman who testified through an interpreter.
She will not be there for my life events. She won't be there if I get married on my wedding day. She doesn't get to know my girlfriend that I have now. It's hard to say. I miss her every day.
And Cairo 7's Allison Grandy was in court yesterday as the lawyers for the plaintiffs wrapped up their case with one final person taking the stand, Phuong Dinh, an exchange student from Vietnam who was also 18 at the time of the crash.
It's kind of like when you play video games and you hear like a grenade or a bomb. It's like it's a big crash, like a big, really loud noise.
She was on the left side of the bus and landed on the floor when the duck boat plowed into the bus.
I looked down and I saw my leg was like this and my bones was just stuck out like that. I'm hurt. Please help me. It's so painful. And then I passed out again.
She was the most severely injured of those survivors, with injuries to her face, her eye, her arm, her leg, and her hip. She spent months in a nursing home after the crash.
I used to be really physically, you know, do everything I wanted, and now I can't.
I see her looking like an old person, using the tools that an old person uses.
That's Dinh's lawyer there at the end. She was telling the jury that Dinh had already had one hip replacement and she was going to need three more in her lifetime. The NTSB investigation into this found that the probable cause of the crash was mechanical failure and improper maintenance. The city and state are also facing some blame because there was no median on the Aurora Bridge. There was also a security bulletin from Ride the Ducks International about the urgent need to fix the axle holding that was not addressed by Ride the Ducks Seattle. One local manager from Ride the Ducks Seattle testified that that was not out of the ordinary.
Honestly, I didn't find out a lot. We didn't go look at the ducks in every case.
The CEO of Ride the Ducks Seattle, Brian Tracy, also took the stand, acknowledging during testimony that he did feel responsible because the buck stops with him.
It was the worst day of my life, and there isn't a moment that I don't think about it every single day.
But he also testified that he had no knowledge of that service bulletin.
We did everything that we could do, knowing what we knew at the time. It was an accident.
And after all of that, the plaintiffs have rest their case. Now, next up, we'll hear from the defendants. First up is going to be Ride the Ducks International after the holiday break.
Okay. I think a lot of questions are out there about whether these vehicles are really suited for tourism, aren't they?
Absolutely. And I know the lawyer for the plaintiffs here opened her start of the trial by saying, look, these are outdated old vehicles. They're not safe anymore. But the manufacturers of those will say that they've been updated and that they are good to go. So we'll see how it turns out. I think there's a lot of people who maybe on their own are concerned about safety, even getting on them these days.
Yeah, I know. I get a little nervous when I pass one, actually, honestly, yeah. after this whole story. It's a shame.
Yes.
Thanks so much, Hannah.
You bet.